And good afternoon and welcome to The Dividing Line. My name is James White and we are live today. And we are going to continue looking at what is going on out there in the field of apologetics. And some people are saying, well, you're only talking about the Roman Catholics. How about you talk about the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses? Well, if they'd put stuff on the web that I could get to and could play for you, that would be great. I don't see a whole lot. If some of you'd like to help me find some of it, that would be great. I would actually take any assistance you could give me in finding real audio files out there that I could grab and then we could play. But especially since it's the Roman Catholics that just seem to have the unlimited resources to be out there throwing around the assertions and the arguments and having the television programs and everything else, it just makes it a whole lot easier to get hold of their information. And I'll tell you something else. Most of these folks that we respond to are folks who won't debate me anyways. We've challenged them to debate, and a couple, you know, one of them maybe has debated me once, decided that wasn't a really good idea, and they're not debating anymore, or they're just too busy, even though I don't know of a one of them who is doing what I'm doing as far as writing the same number of books, teaching, and doing all the rest of that stuff. So not really sure that particular excuse flies very well. But be that as it may, these are folks, many of them, you know, we've responded to Scott Hahn, responded to Carl Keating. They just won't debate. So next best thing, let them speak for themselves. You can't say I'm misrepresenting somebody when I play their whole statement. And you can hear them exactly how they're talking to fellow Catholics or to non-Catholics who call in. I mean, I'm letting them state their own case, and then I respond. So that seems to be, I think, a fair way of handling things, and that's what we have been doing. And I found right off the bat today, we're going to respond to an assertion, to a statement that was aired yesterday. Yes, we are on top of things now. Yesterday on Catholic Answers Live, there was the guest was David Curry. Now, David Curry is a former Baptist. He's the author of Born Fundamentalist, Born Again Catholic. And they opened it up to phone calls, and it was really interesting when a person called in and asked about a book. It's a collection of testimonials from 50 former priests. And it's really interesting to listen to the somewhat offhand critique. And the reason I raise this is, A, generally that's about all we get when we write books. If you go to Amazon, for example, you'll find individuals there who will leave, and I just have refused to get into this silliness, but people will go to Amazon and they will write reviews, and they'll write the stupidest things. I mean, they only use it to get their points across and their 15 minutes of fame, then to give you one star instead of five stars and all that stuff. Just try to drag your book down. It's just ridiculous. But anyways, and then, of course, they'll go over the books they like and, you know, give them five stars and, you know, try to do stuff like that. But there's this kind of response out there. We simply don't get people doing the kind of response to the books that we write that we give to others. You know, I mentioned last week the Webster King work and how people have already written responses to it and they admit they haven't even read it. You know, here's a work that was 4, 5, 6 years in the offing, hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of money spent to buy original resources, time, hundreds and thousands of hours spent in libraries and things like that. And people respond in, you know, 2 days. This kind of surface level, we've got to throw a response out there kind of a thing. We, for example, Eric Svensson's new book, Who Is My Mother? Robertson Genesis Organization is working on a response to that. And I don't know what the URL is. Maybe somebody can grab it real quick in the channel and throw it up there. And if they do, I can throw it up. But there's a man, I think the name is John Pacheco, who works with Robertson Genesis Organization up in Canada, who is supposed to be writing a response to this. Now, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't see any reason to believe that Mr. Pacheco is even capable of doing the kind of research that is necessary to respond to a doctoral thesis in the first place. But be it as it may, I saw an article. what did I do? Eric is your mother? Yes, who is my mother? What are you talking about? Anyways, I saw an article on the web recently that was just, it was infantile. It was so silly. It was ridiculous, by Mr. Pacheco responding to Mr. Svensson. And they're actually, they're actually putting an outline of the book and how much of it's been written, and they're predicting how long each chapter is going to be and how many reference notes it's going to be. How do you, I mean, anyone who does serious research just looks at that and just almost dies laughing. It is absolutely ridiculous. And there's some Helvidius refutation meter, and it is just really, the contrast in seriousness, the contrast in content and presentation, absolutely striking. And I think it's the same thing. There's someone in the channel right now who's been talking about the fact that our main page article right now is on 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and I respond at the end of the article to Robertson Genesis comments from 1994. Well, wow, took like a couple days, and Mr. Syngenis has a response up. On their particular, thank you, Spinster. There's the URL in the channel, catholicintl.com/cai/bookreport.html. There's the URL. You can go and take a look at what I was talking about. Anyways, Mr. Syngenis has posted a response, which would also be at the same main page, catholicintl.com, allegedly responds what I was saying. Well, someone in channel's been posting sections of it. It seems Mr. Syngenis has decided to abrogate an agreement he made a couple years ago in regards to how to do things. Very straightforward, very nasty at times, and somewhat silly. I mean, I read the first few paragraphs where he was saying, well, you know, Dr. White's desperate to get away from, you know, he tries to change context here. All I said in regards to 1 Corinthians 3 is the context is about workers in the church, and I demonstrated why that is from the text. And, of course, my demonstration from the text was ignored, but three paragraphs were provided, and that's why I really don't think I'm going to provide a written response unless there's just some, you know, really grossly silly things there. I think I'll probably just do a program on it and link to it, a voice response. People can listen to it and hopefully gain some positive things out of that. But there seems to be no end to the lengths to which Mr. Syngenis will go as far as file size to attempt to maintain his position. But I would just invite people, read what I wrote, read the main page article, and then go read his and see if you don't see just a huge difference in presentation, content, style. And if people aren't able to see those things, well, you know, like I said to the fellow in channel, there's not much I can do for him. If people are impressed by bluster rather than by content, there's really nothing that can be done. Well, anyways, back to this clip. This is from yesterday. Catholic Answers Live, and here's a response to a caller who asks about one of these books. And listen to what is said about this book.
My question is about a book. I had a friend of mine who reverted back to the church after 18 years. I gave her the Surprised by Truth book, and you know, she said she was going to read it and straighten me out. And I had a message on my phone the following night that I was rocking her world. And she's since come back to the church, and she actually announced it in her Christmas letter to all her Protestant evangelical friends, and she's just been getting hammered really, really bad. And the latest one was a book called Far From Rome, Close to God. It's a book about 50 priests who have left the priesthood. And I was just wondering if either one of you gentlemen knew anything about that book.
Well, Jerry, do you know anything about that book?
Richard Bennett, I think it...
Right. I've heard of the book. Actually, I've seen it. A friend of mine tried to give me that book, a non-Catholic friend, a number of years ago. I picked it up just open it at random, and I'm no theologian or apologist, and I could have driven a truck through the holes in the theological argument. So really, it's a shoddy piece of work, I'll tell you that right now. It's just, it may be 50 ex-priests, but I would guess that it's probably 50 ex-priests who have some kind of an axe to grind, some kind of an agenda against the church, because there's really not much truth to be found in the book. That's all I know about it. I haven't read the whole thing. David, you sound like you're not familiar with it.
I'm not real familiar with it. Tim, let me just make this comment, though. 5 minutes before most Catholics leave the church, they would admit that they know very little bit about the church. 5 minutes after they leave the church, they are experts on Catholicism. If you understand what I'm saying here.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Okay. You know, I was an ex-Catholic, and this is what they believe, you know. And, you know, 90% of the time, it's not at all what we believe. And that's one of the big changes that occurred, you know, when I started to read Catholics that were still in the church, what they were saying they really believed. So, you know, there's a lot of works out there like that from people that really just don't understand exactly what they left. And
my latest line to all the Catholics that have left is that, you know, maybe you owe it to yourself to find out what you left before you start talking about it.
Yeah, there's a difference in attitude that I've discerned. I mean, I know a lot of people that have come to the church, and we're very, very intent on two things. First of all, we're intent on what we came to. We talk about what we came to, what was given to us by that decision. And the second thing, I've never met one single person that has come to the church that has trashed where they were. You know, I have the utmost regard for where I was, and I believe that Jesus Christ used how I was raised to bring me to where I am. And the difference is it tends to be that when people leave the Catholic Church, they don't talk so much about where they came to as where they left and how bad it was. And I think there's a fundamental difference there that maybe gives a hint as to what, you know, where these people are coming from.
Tim, thanks very much for your phone call, and congratulations on assisting your friend in coming back into the church. You might just continue to give her good Catholic materials that should bolster her against the attacks that she is experiencing in her faith.
Okay, that was yesterday on Catholic Answers Live, and so a couple things. It's always best to acknowledge anything that is true in what someone says. And are there former Roman Catholics who are not balanced? Are there former Roman Catholics who truly deserve the phrase anti-Catholic? Are there former Roman Catholics who left the Roman Catholic Church for all sorts of bad reasons instead of good reasons? Yes to all of those things. And obviously there is a tremendous amount of need on our part to be very careful in the argumentation we use, and folks, we have a long track record of offending people and losing possible supporters because we tell people you need to leave groups for the right reasons, and if you, for example, leave Rome because you were mad at a priest or something like that, I still need to talk to you about the gospel. Because if you don't leave Rome because Rome doesn't have the gospel, if you don't leave Rome so you can embrace the truth of God, then your reasons are not reasons that are going to stand up over the long term. And so are those things true? Yes. However, let's look at the other things we say. Well, you could drive a Mack truck through the theological holes, even though the man admitted he hadn't read it. And, of course, I look at Surprised by Truth and throw my hands up in despair at the shallowness of what is said in both of those books. I know that there are full, complete, solid exegetical rebuttals to every argument those people raise. So I could drive a Mack truck through the books that they promote all the time. Carl Keating's Catholicism and Fundamentalism has, it looks like Swiss cheese when you examine it historically and biblically. And that's why I think Mr. Keating will not come out and defend it, except against people he doesn't feel have the ability to actually push him on those issues. So the difference is I read Catholicism and Fundamentalism. The difference is that I took the time to, when he talks about Mary, to look up what is said about Mary in various and sundry resources and so on and so forth. So there's a little bit of a difference at that point. And then also this statement, you know, well, you know, I came to Rome and, you know, I don't trash my old viewpoint. I appreciate what came, what I received in my old church, but now more focused on the positive. Well, that's a nice sentiment. But, you know, and that sounds properly ecumenical and things like that. But in reality, here we have individuals who are promoting giving materials to others that do, quote-unquote, trash their churches, that say they are not actually the Church of Christ, they don't actually have the fullness of the gospel, etc., etc., etc. So they may not use similar language, but the fundamental thrust they're making is, in fact, the exact same thing. So that's, I'm not really sure that's a really valid point to be made, but it is interesting to hear. And we've got another cut that we want to play from yesterday's program here in a few minutes, when we look at the subject of the Mass as, Mr. Curry, demonstrates that, he said in there, you know, people 5 minutes before they leave the Catholic Church admit they don't know much about the Catholic Church, but then 5 minutes later they're experts on the Catholic Church. Well, not exactly. There may be people who do that. But isn't that exactly what Jerry Matytix and Robert Sengenis and these converts say? Oh, I knew my faith and I know that it's, I know where you're coming from. I mean, I have heard that song over and over and over again. All you got to do is tune in EWTN or listen to the debates I've done with these folks, and it's just a constant drumbeat. I know where you're coming from. And yet, as we'll hear from David Curry later on, when he tries to respond to the Protestant use of the Book of Hebrews, he fails completely to actually give the only meaningful argument from the Book of Hebrews. He gives a completely different argument, so evidently he didn't really understand what that was. And interesting, I'm going to go ahead and change the order that I was going to do this in. I just wanted to throw this one out here, and I seemingly do it toward the beginning of each program. You may remember a couple weeks ago when I started doing this, where I'm actually responding to folks, let them give their case, respond to them. These are folks, like I said, that just don't want to engage in debate, so we'll do the closest thing we can, because I am committed to the assertion that truth is most clearly seen against the backdrop of error. And Proverbs tells us the first one to present his case sounds right until his neighbor comes along and examines him. It's real easy when you just present your side to make your side look good. But it's a different issue when you actually have to have give and take. And that's why I like debates. But if these folks consistently decline to utilize that forum and consistently decline our challenges to debate, but they're going to go out there and act like they're apologists, well, we're going to respond to what they have to say. And wouldn't it be interesting if somehow we eventually hear from them going, well, we'd appreciate if you wouldn't do that anymore. That would be, I think, the greatest example of which side is speaking the truth of anything else I can imagine. But anyways, I'm going to switch the order I was going to do these in. I was listening to a program where Patrick Madrid, who, I need to say right up front, is going to be debating me July 11th on Long Island on the subject of prayers and veneration of saints and angels. And that's coming up this year now. So he's not one of those who will not debate. We've debated once before, September 1993, on the subject of Sola Scriptura. Patrick's the editor of Envoy Magazine, which has taken some pretty cheap shots at me. I'm going to hope to ask him about especially the last one on that particular level. But anyways, he was on the program, and this next clip is just fascinating. note the absolute and complete unity that exists between Roman Catholic apologists on this one topic. If you were listening a few weeks ago to Carl Keating when he answered a question on this subject, you'll see almost a lockstep viewpoint. As well as, and this is where you wake up, Dave Hunt, Norman Geisler, and others, in how they get around the utter freedom of God. Notice you'll even hear the line here from Patrick Madrid, God is not a rapist. Well, where have we heard that one before? Listen to this particular clip from Patrick Madrid.
My question is regarding predestination. And I've been having some ongoing discussion with my sister. And she's a Baptist, and I just found out that she informs me she's also Calvinistic. And I don't know whether all the Baptists are or not. But she's using Romans 8 to support that particular line of thinking. And so after that, we were going on to free will. And I was making my feeble points on free will, and she's very good in the Bible. And she says, show me that in the Bible. And so if you could... And it's interesting to note also that she's been using St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas to support the predestination. And I know the church also uses those to support their contention that there is no such a thing, right? So
well,
where can I look?
Let me take a run at that. First of all, Romans 8, of course, is the classic, one of the classic passages for the issue of predestination. The problem with the Reformed or the point of view that John Calvin promoted is that it involves, at least in most instances, it involves double predestination.
Okay.
And Calvin theorized that God creates humanity in two categories, those who are predestined for heaven and those who are created simply for the purpose of damning them to hell. And that would make God into a monster. Now, I know that my Calvinist friends would have a response to that, and I wish we had time to go into greater detail.
Right.
But the point is, the nature of God's love involves freedom by its very definition. You know, when Jesus said, or when St. John said that God is love, right, we see in that that God is not just a loving person, but he embodies love itself. And that means that when you love somebody, that your love must be given freely, and the person who is receiving your love must be free to accept it or reject it.
Right.
Because if you force the person to accept your love, that is rape.
Right.
God is not a rapist.
Right.
And so we know that from even as far back as the time in the garden, that God created human beings with the capacity to choose good or evil, and he did not hinder or thwart them,
right,
from exercising their freedom. And this is another very important point. And this is one of the reasons why the Calvinist double predestination point of view can't work. And that is because not only is God love itself, but also the very nature of our human nature made in the image and likeness of God rests upon the foundation that we are created in freedom, that we're not automatons, we are not marionettes, that God just winds us up and makes us go regardless of what we want.
Right.
So when we consider those, you might say, presuppositions, and then we approach a passage like Romans chapter 8, where it talks about people who are predestined. You know, we read, for example, in Romans 8:29, for those he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, so that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those he predestined, he also called. And those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he also glorified. Now, notice that he's speaking there about people who are predestined for heaven. And the Catholic Church recognizes and admits that there are people who are, in fact, predestined for heaven.
Right.
The Blessed Virgin Mary would be the par excellence example of that. But the Church rejects the erroneous view that there is a second class of people who are predestined for hell.
Well, we've heard that in so many different forms. About the only thing that would separate the standard Arminian from what was just said there was maybe the section about, well, the Church says, and the section about Mary. Other than that, basically what we just heard is exactly what you hear in Arminianism today. And that's what you hear, for example, from open theists who detest so much the freedom of God in his sovereign decree and are so focused upon the worship of man's autonomous will, libertarian free will, the central aspect of human religion, all human religion. And so did you hear any discussion of Romans 8? No. We didn't hear anything concerning what Romans 8 says, its clear assertions. There was no exegesis offered. Instead, you have all these things that are said sort of on the periphery, and it can't mean this because of this, because we assume this, because we have to believe this. The church says this, and therefore, I think that fella's sister, as long as she stays with Scripture, is going to have no problems whatsoever dealing with that particular issue. Well, just want to throw that one in there because I just have to keep telling non-Catholics, if you worship at the altar of free willism, then the guy next to you is a Catholic. Okay, I just trying to get that across to you that at the Reformation the line was clear. And if you sit here and listen to this program and you hear us talking about purgatory, you go, oh, yeah, oh, that's... And you hear us talking about the Mass, oh, yeah, go get him. And then you go and say, but God's under the control of my free will. Hey, you would have been opposed to the Reformation. You would have been opposed to the Reformers. You would have been on Erasmus's side in the debate with Luther. You need to realize you're holding a self-contradictory position, and these folks are going to get you on it. So if we're going to give a meaningful response, then we need to give that response in a consistent manner. And I do not believe that a person who agrees with Rome on the nature of grace, the nature of man's will, the nature of God's decree, is going to be able to consistently give a response to the Roman Catholic system. Just not going to happen. And here's another good example of that. Some of you who listen to the program regularly know that we have a worldwide chat channel called Prosapologion. That's how you pronounce it, Prosapologion. I've heard every possible pronunciation of that as I've traveled around. It's sort of like we have an op that comes in whose name is Charis, Charis. And I've heard every possible pronunciation of that, too, Charis and Charis and everything else. Anyways, we have a chat channel. And of late, it has been very heavily inhabited by Roman Catholic apologists. And one who is in there right now, in fact, but not listening as I can see, called Catholic Answers this week on Thursday and asked about something that I had said to him. And specifically, he was asking James Aiken about an assertion that James Aiken makes. And we come back from this break, we're going to listen to what James Aiken had to say and test it by the light of Scripture here on The Dividing Line. And welcome back to Dividing Line. My name is James White. We're talking about, well, lots of stuff today on the program. And we are listening to what other folks have to say, including some folks in the channel. I noticed that our Catholic apologist is continuing to demonstrate that he doesn't understand the Reformed faith, though he's confident that it's wrong. That's why, that, you know, I don't have any problem being upset about that. Because I've taken the time to learn about the groups that I speak on well enough to be able to show respect to them in that the objections I make to their beliefs are actually what they believe. That doesn't mean I haven't encountered people who didn't know their beliefs well enough, and you're misrepresenting us in each one of the situations. I was able to demonstrate that, in fact, they were the ones who were not understanding the teachings of their own church. But be that as it may, that's going on the channel right now. And interestingly enough, it's the same individual who called Catholic Answers Live and asked a question. What had happened was late last year, just a week or so, a little bit more ago, I came back in channel, and this individual had been talking with one of our regulars in the channel, and they had been talking about John 6:44. And one of the other regular users messaged me something that had been said by this Catholic apologist in regards to John 6:44, and I immediately recognized, as soon as I saw what was said, that what had happened is this person had gone off into the internet and had found a set of notes from James Aiken. Now, Mr. Aiken and I did a radio discussion / debate, and this wasn't the Bible Answer Man. That's just a radio talk. That's just taking phone calls. It's not a debate in any way, shape, or form, even though that's what they call it. I guess that's how they try to make it sound like they've actually debated me when they haven't. Mr. Aiken, anyways. And we did one on, I think it was KIXL in Austin. And we did it on, I think it was on Eternal Security. And John chapter 6 came up. And in the years since then, I have a couple of times run across people who have found his notes posted on his website. And in these notes, Mr. Aiken asserts that in John 6:40, he gets around the message of John 6:44 by asserting that we have here inceptive aorists. Now, an inceptive aorist verb in the Greek language, the more common term is ingressive. Ingressive or inceptive aorists are terms. The aorist is an undefined action in the Greek language. The type of action it describes is undefined. It can be punctiliar, or it can just be the statement that the action takes place without any comment whatsoever on whether it's continuing or anything like that at all. And an ingressive or inceptive aorist is an aorist that emphasizes the beginning of an action rather than a culminative aorist.
A sad, strange little man.
Thank you very much. Jimmy Joe Jay just joined, and I forgot that my system plays that song when Jimmy Joe Jay joins. people are going, I want to get that sound myself. Anyways, in contrast to a culminative aorist would emphasize the end of the action. And then a constative aorist is just simply the standard aorist where there's really no emphasis on a beginning or an ending. Now, constative is the normal use of the aorist. And you have to have certain elements present in the context, in the type of word used, in the context of the word as it is used, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that indicates that it's a ingressive or a culminative. Otherwise, you have to stick with the general usage of the term. So, in other words, you can't just simply throw out, I'm going to assume that this is a an ingressive aorist. No, you have to be able to back up your assertion. When you take, when you're trained in the language, when you take those classes, normally second year in college, second semester in seminary, you have to defend your syntactical choices, is what it's called, to the professor. I remember in second year Greek, I missed an A by one question on one test that was on this very issue. And I disagreed with the professor over whether something was a culminative, a constative, or an ingressive. And I think it was between culminative and constative. And I think now today I'd agree with him. He was probably right, but at the time I didn't think he was. But I missed an A. On one thing like that, I had to be able to defend it, and I wasn't able to do so to his satisfaction. That's how you do it. So anyways, James Aiken is out there, and he's got these notes out here. And the first time I actually ran across this, interestingly enough, was on a Calvary Chapel chat list. Actually, it wasn't a chat list. It was an email list. And I had been invited there because there was a fellow who used the nick Arminian, or Arminius, who was just ripping and shredding on me and how this Catholic had just beaten me up on John chapter 6. So I went into that list. And I responded to everything James Aiken said, and of course, the guy that was beaten up on me immediately became very quiet and was unable to respond to anything. But, of course, after I left, then he got real vocal again, which is a very, very common thing. But anyways, so I responded to it then. Here's an Arminian using James Aiken's materials to try to get around the truth of John 6:44. So anyways, this Catholic apologist posts in the channel stuff directly from James Aiken in these notes. And so I went back to what I had written on the for the Calvary Chapel thing and posted it to this individual. Well, he didn't have any response. He wasn't able to reply to it. And so what he did is he took the time to get a hold of James Aiken and call him about it. Now remember, he's going to ask a two-part question. He's going to ask the specific element about the ingressive aorist. Inceptive aorist is the terminology that Aiken uses. Secondly, but listen carefully to how the senior apologist of Catholic Answers responds this question in light of John 6:44.
Hello, good evening. I have a question concerning John 6 verses 42. 44.
Mm-hmm.
Now, five-point Calvinists will often use this as a proof text for eternal security. And I have read, I would like to know what is the Catholic response to that. And if I may, I would like to follow up with the technical question about the Greek.
May I read that for the listeners?
Sure.
Okay, this is John chapter 6, verses 40 through 44, Paul, yes. Correct?
Yes.
For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him should have eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. The Jews then murmured at him because he said, I am the bread which came down from heaven. They said, is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How does he now say, I have come down from heaven? And Jesus answered them, do not murmur among yourselves. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day.
Okay, well, there are a couple of things in here that would be appealed to by people who hold to the doctrine of eternal security. The first one is in verse 40, where it says, for this is the will of my Father, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him should have eternal life. Well, that's true. That is God's will. But those who do convert and embrace Christ do have eternal life. That's a separate question than can you lose it. Secondly, in verse 44, he says, no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him. And that's true. It requires an initiative of God's grace for individuals to come to God in the first place, the denial of that being the heresy of Pelagianism. And he says that he will raise such individuals up on the last day. But this, again, is presupposing individuals who have come to Jesus and have not subsequently departed. And one finds out, if you look elsewhere in the Gospel of John, in chapter 15 in particular, Jesus says that if anyone does not abide in him, if anyone does not bear good fruit, then the Father comes along, God the Father himself, comes along and removes those branches from Jesus, who is here being depicted as a vine, and the end of those branches is to be burned in the fire. So Jesus indicates that even though you can genuinely be in him, be a Christian, you can be removed by the Father and end up going to a place rather warmer than Tucson.
Okay.
There you have it, Paul. You have a follow-up.
Well, it's a very technical question. I seem to remember reading one of your tracts on this in which you maintain that the infinitive use in verse 44 are inceptive or ingressive, aorist, meaning to continually draw. Now, I've asked a self-proclaimed Protestant scholar who you may know, you debated him once.
What was his name?
James White, who argues strenuously that there's no warrant to take these aorists as inceptive, none whatsoever. And I wanted to ask you what's the scholarship behind your claim?
Well, I would say that it's true that these aorists can be taken as either inceptive or non-inceptive, but you have to decide that question by looking not just at the form of the word, but at broader contextual issues. And as I indicated earlier, when you have elsewhere in the Gospel of John, Jesus indicating that individuals can lose their salvation, as he very clearly does in chapter 15, then that tells you something about how you have to interpret other statements elsewhere in the Gospel of John. So if you have a clear indication in John 15 that folks can lose their salvation, then that means that when you look at verbs and participles elsewhere in the Gospel that can be taken more than one way just by looking at their form, then that is going to indicate to you that you should take them in a way compatible with the clear statement in John 15.
Well, okay, a number of things to look at there. Seemingly, we interpret John chapter 6 in the light of John chapter 15. Despite the fact, of course, that John chapter 6 comes prior to John chapter 15, we are to interpret later passages in the light, previous passages in the light of later passages. I think we can all see immediately that there's a bit of a problem. Secondly, no exegesis was offered of John 6 at all. That's not surprising because I've said many, many, many times that it is simply impossible for anyone who believes in man-centered salvation to start in the Gospel of John chapter 6 and walk through consistently verse by verse in context, following the use of language, following grammatical and syntactical rules that everyone recognizes are valid, and come to any conclusion that is commensurate with the religions of men. The passage is clear, it is very straightforward, and there's just simply no question about it, so we don't have any exegesis offered. Instead, Mr. Aiken, in response to Paul's question, dives away from John 6 over to John 15. Now, he also doesn't engage in any exegesis of John 15. I would direct you to the website, aomin.org/John15. John is capitalized, John15.html, for a exegesis of John chapter 15, not this is what the church says, not this is what my tradition says, but an exegesis of John chapter 15 that demonstrates that in point of fact you are ignoring the context of John 15. Vine in John 15 if you allow the language to speak for itself. If you allow Jesus to define the terms that he himself uses. But did you hear any discussion of that? No. Is Mr. Aiken even aware of those issues? I don't know. I cannot tell. I would actually probably guess that he is not, that he has simply embraced this as being his tradition, and that's what he repeats to people. Then Paul asked the question, well, what about this issue of the inceptive aorist? Now, I should mention to everyone that Paul has apologized to me and in our chat channel. He said it was wrong and sinful, I believe, to use the insult that he used, a self-proclaimed Greek scholar. He recognizes that that I have taught the language for many years, that I have been employed by a major Bible translation, and that that was a unwarranted assertion that that he made at that point in time, and he has apologized for that, so I don't think we need to pursue that any farther. But the response to his question, and it's an excellent question, he asked it very directly. It was very understandable what he is attempting. He's asking Mr. Aiken, You say this is an inceptivarist. Without an inceptivarist identification in John chapter 6, verse 44, your entire interpretation collapses upon itself. So, what is your scholarly backing? What other scholars say this? Where are you getting this? And any person who has ever had to engage in syntactical study of the Greek New Testament knows Mr. Akin did not even begin to answer the question. You do not determine the syntactical utilization of an aorist verb in John 6:44 by making reference to your seemingly infallible interpretation of John 15. You examine the term in its context. There are certain things that we need to know about inceptive aorists. Let's examine some of the claims Mr. Akin makes. We are told by Mr. Akin in his, on his webpage that the Greek word for can in John 6:44 is present tense. If Mr. Akin is referring to dunatai is able, yes, it is a present tense verb. However, dunatai by nature requires a verbal complement. In this case, it is elthine, that is to come. This is a phrase. One of the most common errors of those who have but a little experience in the language is they focus upon words rather than phrases. Syntax is a more advanced subject than grammar, and it is here that Mr. Akin fails the test consistently throughout all of his comments on this particular subject. Elthine, which means to come, is an aorist infinitive form of erchomai. Note that Akin pretends to be giving simple grammatical information in his discussion of this on his website when he is not. An inceptive aorist is an exegetical and syntactical category. When you assert an aorist is functioning in a certain way, you have to give reasons. Akin offers no reasons at all. So let's ask the question, why does he claim this is an inceptive aorist? Well, as Mr. Akin would have to know, there are particular categories that must be fulfilled to identify a word as an inceptive aorist. Specifically, grammars such as Dan Wallace's excellent grammar of the Greek New Testament, its syntactical grammar, says, number one, stative verbs such as basileuein, which means to rule, lend themselves particularly to the inceptive category. Now, think about it for just a moment. I don't think you have to be a Greek scholar to understand this. When you say King John began to rule, you can see that since ruling is something that normally takes place over a period of time, then it's easy to see how you could emphasize the beginning of a period of ruling and the end of a period of ruling, or you could just simply refer to the rule of someone as a whole. Those would be the three kinds of aorists at that point: inceptive or ingressive, the beginning of the ruling, the whole ruling as a whole, constative, or culminative, emphasizing the end of that particular action. See? Stative verbs, then, lend themselves particularly well to the inceptive category. There's a problem here, however. Erchomai is not one of these verbs, which Mr. Akin says is an inceptive. So automatically, the kind of verb does not fit into the category that has been defined by grammarians as indicating inceptive aorist. Secondly, an aorist introducing a new concept, especially to narrative dialogue, can often be inceptive. Well, let's think about that. What do we mean? Well, if you are narrating something that took place in the past, and you are telling people, you know, this has happened and this happened, and then you introduce a new thing, it is easy for an aorist to be used in that way in narrating a story to talk about, well, then someone began to pour water into a bowl or something along those lines. You can see how that would, as you're narrating actions in the past, could be an inceptive or ingressive aorist. But Elthine doesn't fit that category either. I have any Greek grammars that cite this passage as an example of an ingressive or inceptive error. It's not one. Nor do I find any English translations that render the passage to begin to come. Not one. No Roman Catholic ones do. So if your verb doesn't fit, the context doesn't fit, there's not a translation in the world that supports you, not a grammar that supports you, then either James Aiken is the greatest Greek scholar on the planet, and we all, the rest of us, are clueless, or Mr. Aiken is wrong and needs to admit it and needs to pull this material from his site. Next, there is no basis, even if this was an inceptive aorist, for the rendering that Aiken offers, to begin to continually come. That's how he renders it, to begin to continually come. And did you hear in his explanation to Paul that, oh yes, they began to come, but they didn't continue. That's how they get around the idea of the perfection of the work of Christ. Well, they can begin to come, but then they can go away. They don't remain faithful. In fact, just the opposite is true in regards to the rendering of this word. The inceptive aorist translation would simply be began to come with no statement regarding the continuing process. Hence, the rendering offered is simply an error, and I do not believe that Mr. Aiken could find anyone who would substantiate his translation. The fact is, this is not an inceptive aorist. Aiken is an error. I believe the vast majority of Greek scholars would agree this is simply a constative aorist. The action of coming is taken as a single whole, that which no man is able to accomplish outside of the drawing of the Father. There is no lexical, grammatical, or syntactical reason to take it any other way. Next, Aiken asserts that helkuse, the aorist subjunctive of helko, is an inceptive aorist as well. Not only is the same error made regarding the inceptive aorist and its proper translation, but this case even has less of excuse. This is an aorist subjunctive used in an eon me clause. Time elements fall out when you leave the indicative for the subjunctive, and aspect issues are not as clear-cut as in the indicative either. So, helko is not stative, it does not fit the inceptive aorist category, but it is instead another constative. Therefore, we see that Aiken has presented exegesis that is totally unsubstantiated, and on the basis of that innovative idea that these are inceptive aorists, has turned the text on its head. Turned it upside down. Now, I noted that Paul did not have a response in channel. That's why he called Mr. Aiken. Mr. Aiken hasn't had a response either, as we have heard. And hence, I would say that it would be very proper to call upon James Aiken to either remove the material from his website because it has been fully refuted, or defend the material by providing the scholarship that he did not provide to Paul when he called. And we would be more than happy to have Mr. Aiken on our program to defend his comments on John 6:44. All he needs to do is contact our offices and set up a time when he'd like to come on, and we will be glad to do so. I can guarantee you that what's unusual is while we will respond to what they're having to say, I sort of doubt that you're going to hear us on Catholic Answers Live. But I will say again, if Mr. Aiken would like to have home field advantage, I would be glad to come on Catholic Answers Live and discuss this issue with him. You might say, well, that's, you know, who are you to go on Catholic Answers Live? Well, I think the fact that I've written a number of books on Roman Catholicism, done nearly 30 debates against the leading Roman Catholic apologists, teach Greek and Hebrew, should give me sufficient basis to go ahead and discuss this with Mr. Aiken. So why don't we put that invitation out and see if Mr. Aiken will do what's right and either pull the information, admit that it's wrong, and come up with some other response, whatever that might be, or just let's discuss it. Let's debate it. I think that is the way that things need to be taken care of. Well, when you listen to The Dividing Line, you get to hear both sides, and that means the phone lines are open. Maybe Mr. Aiken would like to call in today Maybe some others who would like to, maybe you hold to James Aiken's perspective, or maybe to what Patrick Madrid said, or David Curry, or whoever else. Give us a call at 866-854-6763. 866-854-6763 is the phone number. And we'll be taking calls after the break. I haven't even started to scratch everything that I have available today. It is truly incredible. We still have the second part from David Curry to look for, look at, and then we have a bunch of stuff from Steve Ray on the papacy, and just not enough time to get it all in, but that's what we're doing here on The Dividing Line. We're going to go ahead and take our top of the hour break, and our phone callers at 866-854-6763. We'll be right back. And welcome back to The Dividing Line. My name is James White. We are looking at what the leading Roman Catholic apologists are saying. In fact, today we've been talking about stuff they said yesterday. less than 24 hours ago, in fact. And so we are trying to keep up with things here. I know some of the things we're playing were said months ago. Wow, I didn't have an MP3 player back then to be able to listen to stuff while I'm driving around and doing stuff like that, and that's been a cool addition, no two ways about it. Before we take our first caller, let me just throw this one out here. I want to at least get to it since I mentioned it. A caller called in regarding the subject of the Mass in the Book of Hebrews, and it's very interesting to hear how David Curry, a former Protestant, but not a Reformed Protestant, responded to this particular call.
Crisis that Christ replaced, and he did. Oh, okay. He replaced those, but he instituted the Mass.
Well, you know, it would be helpful if it started at the beginning. Let's try that
now,
again.
My question is concerning the Mass. I was always taught that the Mass is a sacrifice, and I understand that sacrificial terminology is used by our Lord in the Last Supper. I understand that the Eucharist was described as a sacrifice, as a fulfillment concerning Malachi's prophecy, chapter 1.
Mm-hmm.
But my Protestant friends would point out in the letter to the Hebrews on how can Mass be a sacrifice, because Jesus died once and for all.
Okay.
Well, in light of the letter to the Hebrews, how should I respond?
Okay, that's a very good question. And I think there's a couple things we need to discuss real quick, Vince. First of all, the Mass is a sacrifice, but it's an unbloody sacrifice. In other words, it's a part of the sacrificial atonement that Christ did on the cross. It's not a separate sacrifice. It's actually part and parcel of that. It's us joining in that sacrifice that's eternal in heaven. When St. John looked at Christ in heaven in the book of Revelation, he saw a lamb that was slain, and not a lamb that had been slain, not a lamb that will be slain, but a lamb that was slain. Eternally, that sacrifice is in heaven because time is different than it is down here. It's eternally present.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so first of all, let's make that distinction. This is not a separate sacrifice. This is a sacrifice that's part and parcel. It's an unbloody sacrifice that's part and parcel of the passion that our Lord went through. So that's the first distinction that we need to get them to understand. We're not saying that this is a sacrifice that's different. It's not another sacrifice. It's not a second sacrifice. It's the same thing. And the second thing, though, is that I think we need to help them to understand, and this is something that you really have to watch, and I say this with as much kindness as I can, you really have to watch Protestants on this. And they take the book of Hebrews totally out of context.
Really?
Now, what is the book of Hebrews? What was it written for? Well, it was written just before the Jerusalem was conquered and the temple was demolished in 70 AD by the Romans. right? And Hebrews was written just a little bit before that, probably about a decade and a half, or maybe, you know, right in that range somewhere, maybe a decade before. So you have these Jerusalemite Christians, these Jewish Christians, the Hebrews, the Hebrew Christian, who this is written to, in Judea, trying to be Christians, and being terribly, terribly persecuted by the Jewish leaders. The Jewish leaders, in about 64 A.D., convinced Rome, and Nero at that point, that these Christians were subversive, and they weren't a part of Judaism anymore. They had gone off, and so Rome turned its wrath upon the Christian church, along with the Jewish leaders, who'd been, you know, pointing their wrath toward these poor Hebrew Christians all along. And as a result, a lot of the Hebrew Christians were saying, you know what, let's just go back to the sacrificial system. I mean, that was set up by God. But, you know, and if we go to the temple and we do our sacrificial system, we don't get all this grief. You know, certainly God doesn't want us to go through this much suffering when there's this other system over here that we know was ordained by God and Moses set it up. And so we're going to go back to that. And that you see that if you read the book, you see that tension in there. It's not talking about the Mass. It's talking about the Old Testament sacrifices, the bloody sacrifices that Christ replaced. And he did. Okay. He replaced those. But he instituted the Mass.
that's what bring me up means. Notice that, Mr. Curry just doesn't quite understand the argumentation that has been used for a long time in regards to this particular issue. No one is saying that the sacrifices that they were talking about in the book of Hebrews was the Roman Catholic Mass. In fact, it's our argument that that concept didn't even develop for centuries upon centuries. So obviously that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is, first of all, that you cannot make the leap that he does, that an unbloody sacrifice is the same as the bloody sacrifice, because that's not the point of the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews contrasts the repetitive sacrifices of the Old Covenant with the one-time sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And that one-time sacrifice was a bloody sacrifice. Rome does say it's the same sacrifice. We say it can't be, because A, it's unbloody, and B, and this is where only Reformed folks say this, B, it doesn't accomplish what the sacrifice of Christ accomplishes. So, there you have the issue. Now, Mr. Curry was not Reformed, and so it's understandable that he wouldn't understand the strongest argumentation. I'm not going to go into all the stuff in Hebrews, because we did that a few weeks ago when we played Scott Hahn's presentation, which was a much more polished presentation. Mr. Curry was basically giving the exact same argument, just not with the flowery language that Scott Hahn gave a few weeks ago. And if you want to hear about what was said at that particular time, the archives are available at straightgate.com. But it is fascinating to hear a Roman Catholic saying, now you've got to watch those fundamentalists, those Protestants, because they'll take Hebrews out of context. We're not taking Hebrews out of context. Yes, there was pressure being put upon Hebrew Christians to go back to the old ways. But Mr. Curry, you're the one presenting a system that's built upon the old ways. You're the one presenting the system that has the repetitive sacrifices that perfect no one. So the problem is, the application is, that when we look at what the Book of Hebrews says concerning the sacrifice of Christ, it contradicts the results of the Roman Catholic teaching, and therefore the Roman Catholic teaching must be rejected. That's how you test it, by the Scriptures. And so we see again the importance of being consistent in the argumentation that we use, consistent in the theology that we hold. Because when we do not hold to consistent theology, we end up with lots of problems. 866-854-6763. Let's go ahead and take our first caller, and I believe we have Johnny back with us again. Hello, Johnny.
Hey, how you doing, James?
Doing pretty good.
Good, good. Bro, I got three questions for you, if you will allow me to do so.
We'll see what they're about.
All right. The first one has to do with justification, and it's in connection with a point that Roberts and Genesis made in his debate against you on justification. He said that in the book of James chapter 2, you made the point that it was the demonstration of righteousness that was referred to when Abraham took his son Isaac up to the mountain to sacrifice him, that was works. And then that's what the word justification meant, that it was a demonstration of righteousness. But then he said that in, I don't remember which verse it was, but I don't have my Bible in front of me. It says that, as it is said in Scripture, Abraham believed on and he was reckoned to him as righteousness. And he says that the word for justification, dikaiosune or something like that, that it has the meaning of demonstration, and then it has the meaning of declaration, a forensic declaration, and then he says, for the Protestant position to hold water, of course, it has to go from forensic, from demonstration to forensic, and then to demonstration again. And he said that the term justification never has that meaning in any of the secular literature or in the New Testament in general. Now, I don't think, if I remember right, I don't think that you got to respond to that particular point.
Well, Mr. Sengenis makes lots of claims and rarely is able to back up his claims. There is a 24-page chapter on James chapter 2 in the book, The God Who Justifies, and the issue of demonstration was laid out, I think, almost too painfully in the exegesis that I provided there from the very beginning. So the problem is Mr. Sengenis focuses upon words like Mr. Akin rather than upon phrases and uses. That is one of the major faults that I would have with all of his material. Mr. Sengenis is not a Greek scholar. And he focuses upon single words rather than their relationship to others. And the simple fact of the matter is, James talks about the demonstration in verse 18. He uses these terms himself, and therefore to say, well, it never has that meaning. Well, wait a minute. Words have meanings in context.
Mm-hmm.
And since deixon appears in the context, then the entire assertion is absurd to begin with. I was not saying that the word outside of its context includes the concept of demonstration. I'm saying James uses it in the context. The word deixon is there. You have to deal with that. And it's somewhat frustrating because this is very similar to what he's doing in this current response that he's written to the stuff in 1 Corinthians 3. I provide exegesis, and I'm just going to give you my personal opinion. I think anyone who's dealt with this area will back me up, and that is Mr. Sengenis doesn't do exegesis. I don't think a faithful Roman Catholic can, who is trying to substantiate infallible magisterial proclamations, because the conclusion that you have to come to has already been decided. Rome's already told you. So the idea of actually exegeting the text just simply isn't there.
Right. As I read the passage, that's the interpretation I got when I was younger myself. But is he right in saying that none of the secular literature contain a verb like justification or whatever it is? I don't know Greek words and all that stuff. But a word that can be repeatedly used in one particular paragraph and have two different meanings, where you'll have one meaning in one occurrence, then another meaning in another occurrence, and then go back to the original meaning in the following occurrence.
Again, Mr. Sengenis doesn't know what he's talking about. John uses single words like here in two different ways within three words of each other. That is absolutely absurd. Again, the meanings of terms are derived from phrases and not merely from, well, here's a word, it means this. No, here's a word, and this is its semantic domain. You can then use it in context with other words to communicate many different things that can draw from different elements of its semantic domain. So, no, that's a completely false assertion.
All right, what about the term, let me see if I can get this right, I think it was the term trogon?
Yes.
To eat.
Right. They're excellent example. He says, see, this has the literal meaning of chew and so on and so forth. Wonderful. But a word has a meaning in context. And when you allow Jesus in John chapter 6 to determine his own context, he started in John 6:35, told us exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about coming to him, believing in him to assuage hunger and thirst. And these individuals reject that. They do not want that. They want the only hunger and thirst they have is physical, and Jesus is saying, you're missing the whole point. You don't understand what I have done. You have not seen the signs with faith. You are unbelievers. You must have a vital relationship with me. And so he uses a very strong term. But to think that that means, well, since it means to mash with the teeth, that's somehow different than drinking. Well, drinking means drinking. And Jesus used that in the context of what? Of believing in him, coming to him.
Right.
Jesus defined his terms beginning at John 6:35, and even before then, really. You simply are again, missing the very forms and functions of language to say, well, this is a term that means to chew. Fine. If I say to you, Johnny, why don't you chew on that? Uh-huh. Am I asking you to put your phone in your mouth and start crunching?
Right.
Well, of course not.
So are you saying that there would be no single Greek scholar, even from the Roman Catholic side, would agree with his assertion that the term trogon, or the term for drink, has to be taken literally?
Well, first of all, you will find a scholar who will believe anything. So let's scholars at the Jesus Seminar that will say absolutely positively anything. So let's demythologize scholarship. The point is, does the literal meaning of trogon require us in John chapter 6, when used in context, to believe that what Jesus was saying is you need to gnaw on transubstantiated flesh, a concept that no one came up with for 1,000 years? And the answer to that is no.
Okay.
Greek and Hebrew scholars will have to admit, if they even want to be called a scholar, that a term has meaning when it is used with other terms.
So it's not a law then?
No, of course not. You can't. There is no such thing as saying, well, a word has meaning X, and therefore I'm going to insist that no matter what context you use it in, chew means chew, and therefore it is improper for you to tell Johnny to chew on this, because that violates my use of that term. No, of course not. That's not
so
how we speak.
He's wrong in negating the figurative meaning of the
obviously,
word.
Okay. Obviously.
My third question. Do you have any callers waiting?
I honestly don't know.
Okay. This has to do with the tape series, which I'm sure you've listened to, by Tim Staples. It's called Twisted Scripture, Sola Scriptura Exposed.
Not sure if I have or not.
Okay, it's a 3-tape series. I think it's tape 3, and I think it's side 2, I'm not sure though. He mentions the issue of what we as Protestants have commonly called the 400 silent years in which the Apocrypha was actually written.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that Protestants have this tradition that they get from Josephus, that we get from Josephus, which is that the Spirit of God was lifted from Israel in the sense of no prophets like Moses or Elijah, etc., for about 400 years.
Right. Actually, that comes from the Mishnah, where Josephus says it, but the Mishnah also substantiates that.
Is the Mishnah before Josephus?
The Mishnah is the codification of Jewish tradition 250 years after Christ, but the tradition that it codifies would go back into the same period as Josephus.
Okay, well, the thing is, Tim mentioned something that he, I guess, was supposed to refute Protestant theology or something, and that's why I'm asking you, being that you know about textual scholarship and all that. He says that Josephus contradicts himself, where he quotes from Josephus, and I wish I had the writing in front of me, and also from Philo, where he says that the dating of those books, because they give listings of kings in Philo and Josephus, where the dating of those books would leave Ezra and Nehemiah, or for them, first and second Esdras, in the year 300 B.C. What's your take on that?
I haven't the foggiest idea what you're asking or what he's saying.
Okay,
sorry.
He says that Josephus in Antiquities, Book 2, Chapter 8, gives those datings. And
gives
so
datings for what?
The kings that are mentioned in Nehemiah and Ezra, would land under the period of 300 BC rather than before the four. In other words, he's saying that if Ezra and Nehemiah are written in 300 BC, then the tradition that there were 400 silent years is out the door.
Well, A, who would care? What's that got to do with anything?
Uh-huh.
And B, if he's trying to argue that Ezra and Nehemiah were written 100 years later, so what? Let's not even argue about that. I don't see how that's relevant. Mm-hmm. But so what? The fact of the matter is, when the apocryphal books were written, the books themselves recognize the spirit of prophecy has left since Malachi, and unless he's trying to basically, it sounds like he's trying to throw sand here to try to impress an audience and not really make any particularly meaningful points to anyone who's actually listening to what he's saying. But if he's trying to say that apocryphal books are written, the only thing I could possibly see is going on here is he's saying that apocryphal books are written concurrently with canonical books.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow therefore negates the argument that the Holy Spirit of prophecy had left or something along those lines. I don't know. It would seem to me a whole lot easier for him just simply to say that who cares what the Jews said, because basically that's what I discover when I talk to Roman Catholics. In fact, just this past week in Channel, an individual came in. I'm not sure if he's still there here. Let me scroll down here. He keeps changing names. I don't see a particular, I don't think he's there right now, but we were pointing out that the scriptures say that the scriptures were given to the Jews, and therefore their view of the canon should be relevant. He's like, who cares what the Jews believe? The Jews rejected Christ. Well, that's the normal response.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, I'm not really sure why Mr. Staples would go this way other than to simply sound like, wow, he's really done research into history. If he does research into history, then he knows that those same sources, such as Josephus, give us a 22-book Old Testament canon that does not include his books, that Philo does not quote them as being canonical either. So, you know, what does that mean?
Well, I'm not saying that this in any way, shape, or form proves it. I'm just out of curiosity,
yeah,
wanting to know about the dating of the book with your ticket.
I have seen nothing that would, liberal scholarship would put a large portion of the Old Testament into the intertestamental period. It's real easy to find folks, especially, you know, Daniel, way past the events that talks about, because they don't believe in prophecy. So there's no end to stuff that you can quote that would allegedly say, well, this is an individual, this is a book that was written, you know, much later than Malachi, or much later than 400 BC or whatever. But I don't see how that's relevant outside of the fact that if you push it too far, then you've got a problem with the historical fact that the canonical books were laid up in the temple as early as 200 BC.
Yeah, the issue of the dating thing, because as you know, I was some months back, I was in an email discussion with Tim, and one of the things that I asked him was for the dating concerning the book of Baruch, because I had told him that he had said in the tape series that the book of Baruch was written during the time period when Daniel was alive or when Jeremiah was alive, and he said, I don't remember ever saying that, so I had to go back into the tape series, give him the actual quotation, and show him where he could hear it himself, and then he was like, oh, I didn't realize that I had said that. Yeah, he was back to the original position where it seemed like he was shying away from it.
That's the danger of his job and my job, and that is when you open your mouth as frequently as we do,
mm-hmm,
eventually you can't remember everything that you said.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to pick on him for that, because somebody could pick on me about it. I can guarantee you that. And the older I get, the more I recognize how dangerous that all is. But anyways, well, hey, you're still out there in the thick of things, Johnny, and I don't know how you do that and still serve up those hot, fresh cheeseburgers. I don't know how you do it. Do you sort of sneak some, tracks into the wrappers or something like that? Oh, wait a minute. Isn't there verses on the bottoms of the cups or something?
Yes,
like that?
Yes, John 14:6 and John 3:16 that I know of.
There,
I don't know,
well, when you can start putting John 6:44 or, you know.
Also, that one at Esther Schneider. Well, could I ask you one more question, or do you got someone?
Let me... looks clear to here. Normal as all those as normal. The folks in the chat channel are all sitting there, and they're actually somebody was saying you call in a lot, and as someone pointed out, well, actually, I can't repeat exactly what Wonky said, but he said the rest of us are too scared, and I'll just use the term chicken for what he said. So
Did you threaten to sing again?
No, I have not threatened to sing whatsoever. There has been no singing, and there will be no singing because I've still got I don't know how many cuts here to play. I've got another program's worth already sitting here. So, anyways.
All right, my question has to do, but this isn't on Roman Catholicism.
Oh, okay.
Okay, it has to do with a discussion that I got from Rich that you had with, what was that name, Gail Ripplinger on the New Age Bible version?
Yes, good old Gail.
Well, the thing is, Mrs. Ripplinger, you were talking about the Johannine comma.
Mm-hmm.
And how the Greek manuscripts prior to that one with the issue of Desiderius, Erasmus, etc.,
mm-hmm.
That none of the Greek manuscripts prior to that one had contained the Johannine comma. But she mentioned something that, of course, the show was ending, so you weren't able to respond or anything like that. But she was mentioning that many church fathers, such as Athanasius and mm-hmm. many others, had quoted from the comma Johannine.
Right. That's what they claim. Of course, when you think about that there is one God, that is a very common summary statement. And so there's two issues. They say Cyprian is the first to quote-unquote quote from it. That assumes a certain interpretation of what he said, A. B, that also assumes a certain textual state of Cyprian's writings that have come down to us, and the study of patristic citations and their textual transmission is still in its infancy. There's not a whole lot of money to be found to support the study of the textual state of patristic citations, and all of those would exist primarily in Latin. And if you've ever looked at, for example, the earliest church fathers, for example, Ignatius, there's a tremendous difference between the Latin version of Ignatius and the Greek version of Ignatius, and even then there are variations in the few manuscripts we have of Ignatius. And so to attempt to correct the New Testament manuscript tradition on the basis of patristic citations is an extremely questionable thing to get into in the first place, because when you say, well, Cyprian said this, well, what manuscript of Cyprian and how old is it? Most of the time those types of questions are not even asked, let alone does anyone have the information to answer it. So really that becomes the issue. If the comma Johannium, and even Dean Burgon said this, and there, of course, Dean Burgon is their big favorite. I don't think Burgon would have supported their position had he lived to this day, but they love to quote Dean Burgon. Dean Burgon said regarding the comma Johannium that if the comma Johannium is original, then there is absolutely no science of textual criticism left. Because if that passage could disappear completely from the Greek manuscript tradition, then we have no idea what the original Greek manuscript tradition was. Now, they won't quote him on that. You will never find them. You won't find the people. You won't find D.A. Waite and these other people who are constantly quoting Burgon as if he is the be-all and end-all of all things. You won't find them quoting him on that one because that goes against their position. But that's exactly what he said.
So how did he get into the Latin?
Well, probably the same way that John chapter 5, verse 4 did. 1 John 5, 7 is a commentary on 1 John 5, 6. And so probably the same way that John 5, 4 did, it was probably a columnar note, that is a note that someone had put in the side of a column explaining what the three witnesses of 1 John 5, 6 was. And what happened with both that and John 5:4 in the gospel is...
Oh, I don't know what John 5:4 says.
John 5:4 is where the angel would come down, stir the waters.
Oh, yes.
And it's very easy to understand how someone listening to a sermon that had no idea why these people were laying around this pool in the first place. Well, why are they laying around the pool? Well, the preacher happens to know. So a person puts a note in the side column and says, that was because an angel, they thought an angel would come down, stir the waters. That's how stuff like that got into the text. Now notice, it was the tendency of scribes to be conservative. That is, they would make sure to include anything. They didn't exclude anything. And that's a good thing. What that means is we know we have the originals. We just simply need to recognize that there are things such as that that accrued over time. And when the oldest manuscripts do not have them, then we're able to recognize those things. But it's better than the scribes being non-conservative and cutting things out.
It's just that they had told a Mormon had told me that they had edited in there because of the Arian controversy.
No, I don't think that that's the case at all. I don't think there's any evidence for that.
All
and
right,
thanks
God
for your call, Johnny.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, God bless. Well, another fast 90-plus minutes, a minute or two long today, but I'm sure you all appreciated that, and I know Johnny did. Thanks for listening in today, and we'll be back again next week here on The Dividing Line. Thank you very much for participating, both in the chat room and, of course, on the telephone calls, and also for giving us an opportunity to respond to what's being said out there. We truly hope that giving an answer for the hope that's within us is encouraging to you, that you'll take this information, go out there, share the gospel with those who've been deceived. Thanks for listening in. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-0318 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. for The Dividing Line.